Well, everybody, welcome to Sonic Talk, episode 798. Gosh, we're only a couple off 800. That feels like a big number, doesn't it? This is the Music Technology Podcast. We talk about all things to do with music technology, synthesizers, drum machines, instruments, mixing, production, performance, recording, the whole gamut, and many other things that are now introduced because it's so technology based. There's just sort of more and more. It seems to cover more and more. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much to our friends in the chat. I think it's not working again. I think I've got an issue with this, but I'll bring up the YouTubes. Thanks very much to everybody in the YouTube: Peter James Stephen, Jumpstar, Legacy Hand, of course Wagyu for moderating and handling some of the back end stuff, which sort of joins all the chats together. Very much appreciated. We've got a few housekeeping things to do before we get into anything, and I'll start with that because there are a few. So let me see, I've got the running up. We've got a few days left to run the ACDR, the Sonic Couture competition. That finishes on the 19th, and we've got another competition the week after. If you want to enter that, that is very much something that you can do. And I got the link right this time because it doesn't take you to a dodgy site. And then, of course, one other thing that I want to say is Dom's family have decided to put some reductions out on their on Dom's studio kit. So if you're looking, but you weren't quite ready to drop that sort of cash, there's a bit of reductions. Check out the latest prices over there. It will really help the family out. I think they just want to kind of move the stuff. It's using up a lot of space, and I think they need to kind of think about moving house and stuff. And it's just, you know, it's a blockage. Sad days, but if you want to, there's some really good stuff there anyway. So do check that link out. Okay. Right. Okay. So thank you very much for everybody for hanging in there for the admin stuff. We can crack on and get on with some things because there's some stuff. But first of all, let's introduce our guests. Let's head over to London where we can see Yoad Nivo from Nivo Sound. He's over there, plugin developer, consultant, mixer, Atmos guy. Busy as ever, Yoad. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. And it's good to be here. I haven't been on for a while. It seems like a long while, but maybe it's only been a few weeks. But yeah, always good to be back.
Soon mounts up, eh? And, I have a question for you, actually.
Yes, yeah.
I have a question. Raffle Custery posted on Patreon. He said, could you possibly ask Yoad about the H-string guitar that was hanging behind you? Someone deeply rooted in the metal scene, I'm a guitarist, so I really piqued my interest, eager to learn more about it. I don't know if you've got it around there at the moment, but he was just curious to know what it was. And as we can ask, we will.
It's my first venture into the more than 6-string and less than 12-string guitar. and this is a... This is a, I don't know, maybe someone can recognize the, it's kind of a known brand, but I saw it for not too much, and I just thought I had to buy it. And funnily enough, it came with the 8th string, kind of, I think it was a B-stock or something, even though it's okay, maybe it has like a little dent here or something. The 8th string was the same width as the 7th, and it was a bit weird, so I put a bass A. It's F sharp, so it's kind of a tuned down bass string.
It's like a Chapman stick.
But these string holes were too small for the string ring, so I had to swap it for like a normal one, and then I'm not gonna play it because I haven't tuned it for ages. No,
you haven't.
But it's quite good.
I don't know why that is.
Weird to play it. Does anyone know? I used to know.
I can't remember. It's like an L, isn't it? So I don't know what that logo is.
Legator.
Okay, there we go. Well, thank you. That's great.
Quite good for the money I paid. I didn't want to go to into something too expensive before I I have a baritone guitar, but that's kind of it, that's the kind it's of different. Goes to 11 of the baritone of the, yeah. sort of right, stuff. It's one Excellent. More.
Well, thanks for clearing that up. I'm sure you'll be delighted. Let's also jump over to let's zoom across the Atlantic to or we could go around the other way, I suppose, but let's take the Atlantic routes a little bit more. Richard Nickel from Pittsburgh Modular, of course, nice to have you back again. How's everything going your end? I should say Richard, of course, is the head honcho and lead product designer of Pittsburgh Modular fame.
That's what I do.
Yes, absolutely.
I have a Tide keyboard behind me. I have my Analog Rhythm, which I think I'm going to put up on Reverb sometime this weekend.
Right.
And it's time to – I tend to go through gear pretty frequently. I get something and I want to understand how it works, and I want to understand why it sounds the way it sounds and sort of understand the decisions that other designers have made. So I keep stuff long enough that it'll entertain me or give me value, and then I sort of move it on. So I don't tend to keep stuff, a whole lot of stuff, but I eventually get around to having just about everything. So this is my little collection at the moment. I do really like the I have the MPC up there as well, which I really
oh yeah, is that the one?
Playing. Yeah.
All right.
And
nice.
that thing's a lot of fun to play with. I've been using it recently to make the Taiga keyboard a poly, which is fun to do. You sample it and then just play it as a poly synth, which is nice. So that's what I've been playing.
Has that got auto sample in it? Because I know I've been playing with auto sample. I was trying to get, because I did, I don't know whether I'm allowed to do this, but I guess it's physical model, but I built a piano in Astrolab, which is really compressed and EQ'd and has quite an interesting sound. And I multi-sampled it and put it on Patreon for those who are interested. And it sounds really good, but I just suddenly thought, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But I think I tried it in MPC, but the MIDI routing in MPC Beats is a nightmare. It just doesn't work the way I expect it. I'm sure it works fine, but I can't figure it out, so I did it in decent sampler, but I have to play with one of those.
It's interesting. It did take me a long time. This is actually the second MPC one I've owned, because the first one I just didn't get on with it very well. It took me a long time to really get my head around that workflow. I don't come from really a beat making background.
Right.
I come from a more traditional sequencer style background, so it's taken me a while, but now that I finally have my head around it, I really do enjoy the workflow. And I like anything that's sort of hardware based, anything that gets me away from staring at my laptop. It helps keep my mind in that music making mode and away from
friction free
sort of bookkeeping.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, wait, hold on. There's a notification coming from insert service here that is irrelevant to what you're doing at the moment. Yeah, I totally get that. Very, very useful. And I think that's something that people tend to forget about when they're moaning about, well, I could do that on my VST. And it's like, yeah, you can, absolutely, but it's a different experience. Anyway, that sort of chuckle you heard there was from Paulie Bow, Magical Synth Adventure, with your nearly full modular case up there. Is that a new Eurorack
nearly
case
full.
In yellow? Yeah, nice.
Yes, I got it off Etsy by Ico Case because I wanted something pretty deep. I think it's about 12 centimeters deep.
There's
a few modules that I've wanted to buy for a while, which are quite, you know, big, deep modules. So, yeah, it's nearly done. And it's a nice new backdrop for me, you know, that you can stare
it
at.
It is. You've got all the lights. You've just bought it for the light show, have you, rather than the actual audio?
It's all a facade. there's no actual audio capabilities whatsoever. It's just a light show, so I look like I know what I'm doing, basically.
What are you going to put in your last HP?
Yeah, last HP. I think Richard might be pitching for it.
I would go for the Pittsburgh filter. Which is amazing.
I've already got a Pittsburgh filter down there, one of the early ones, with the big knob.
Yeah, I have one. It's such an amazing filter.
It's going to be
I don't know if you can see it, but most of my modular is Pittsburgh. They're on the on your left.
Brownie points.
Yeah, well, there you go. Oh, yeah, guys, get a room, last, come on.
My last little hole is going to be filled with the Dupfer A112 sampler, which is a very, very odd sampler. It only has about 256K of RAM, but that's fine for me. Oh. And you can step through any sample kind of like a wavetable. And it connects to a Windows 95 computer. Excellent. Even today.
So it's got really terrible glitchy interpolation, has it, as well, I hope.
That's it. It's basically 8-bit and awful, so that's why I want it, because I've got plenty of, you know, really good, pristine sampling sources. So anything that sounds a bit naff, I love.
Yeah.
There we go.
Easily done. Easily done. Right, I think we probably should get onto a topic, but I'm thinking, because what seems to happen, this topic is likely to be a bit longer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be rather crass and I'm going to throw an ad in there first. Okay, right. This was a just in, because I want to say thanks very much to Synth Samurai, who was in the chat room earlier, and he said, are you going to talk about this? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I missed it because I'm not glued to the Instagram in this particular instance. But it turns out that Mike Dean, who is a sort of happening producer of some note in the US and has been linked with several Moog products, has now released a video which ultimately, where is it? Yes, is, well, it's basically what we thought was going to be the mirror. It's not. It's this. This was an Instagram post by Mike in his studio. And basically, there it is. It's not the mirror, it's the Muse. Looks like we've got two oscillators, twin filters, envelopes on faders, built-in effects, six voices, from what I could gather. And some good memory locations, all of that sort of thing. No other information is forthcoming. This is a very unusual approach they've taken. Well, I'm not unusual. I mean, it's just they're teasing it purely via Instagram, by the looks of it, and via this. Well, they also did the Super Bowl thing, and there's been a couple other bits, but this is the most graphical version of it. So there we go. We have it. We have no other information. We don't know how much it's going to be. Looking at it, it's got to be in the $2,000 range, just purely for a six voice analog poly. Can't be much less than that, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, I may be wrong, because obviously now that in music, now that they own Moog, it's quite possible that they've it's probably a bit early in the game, they may have brought in their kind of manufacturing clout and made it more affordable. I don't know. What do we think? I think we should probably come to Richard first, because you're an analog engineer. What do you reckon? It's got to be, what, $2,000? I would think. I mean, I could be wrong.
I'm thinking $3,500.
Okay, right.
If the rumors are that it's based on the voicing of the matriarch and the grandmother, that's discrete analog stuff. And to put six voices together like that, so you have 12 oscillators, 12 filters, that's a lot of resistors and transistors and capacitors. And Moog is still a prestige brand, and I can't imagine they're going to come out with something that's, you know, that if $2,000, that would be cheaper than the matriarch, and that doesn't really seem to make any sense to me. But the instrument itself, then, you know, we can speculate what the price is, but I don't think that's the important thing. The important thing is the instrument itself. And one thing that I did notice in watching the video is that they did this cool slider thing for each of the oscillators, where on the left-hand side, there's a knob that goes from a triangle to a saw, and then you have a sort of a fader slider that goes to pulse width on the other side. So you can blend between those two sets of waveforms to create something interesting. And it looked like each one of the oscillators had that. So I think that in itself is just a fun little thing. This whole interface of this, it just looks like such a fun instrument. You know, and it has, I saw it has arpeggiators and a sequencer and a clock source. There's a lot going on in here, but it's laid out so cleanly and so really well done. I think this is going to be a big instrument for Moog, because it looks so approachable. It looks doesn't look like a toy, but it looks like you already know how to use it. And that's a big deal for this type of thing.
I did notice that it's got a slightly, you can't really see it there, but it's got a slight, it's like a double LED that would be about the size of what you'd maybe see on the Sub 37 or something. So it's a lot sort of, there's a bit more, and it's backlit. So it may be something looking a little bit more like a DSi thing. I don't know. What do you think, Yoad? Is this, are you looking for another analog poly in your life? And they've got to get it right, I suppose, haven't they? Because they didn't last time.
Yes. To me, it looks kind of the most Juno-y, Roland-y thing that Moog ever done, except for the fader caps, which are the poly Moog caps.
That's where it was, right. Yeah.
But the layout and the fact that it's kind of, it looks from afar, you could think it's a Juno, not the colors, but the kind of layout and the, I don't know, dimensions or something, or proportions or something like that, or Dave Smith kind of sequential, you know, something kind of with a more sort of Roland approach than I've ever seen coming from Moog. I can't bring myself to say Moog. I've been saying Moog for all my life, and it's like,
it's okay. I'm still being flacked for it, and I occasionally remember, and it sort of makes more of a deal of it. I get people saying, how can you get that wrong? It's disrespectful. This is a man's name. And it's like, yeah, but it's also, you know, I don't say Hoover, do I? I say Hoover. But anyway, we'll let that go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
I have a funny story about that with the Dutch name. I'll try to make it short, but I was working on a production in Holland, and I was staying in a little village, in a little kind of whatever small hotel in that village, and the A&R drove me at night after the session, and the next morning I called him and I said, yeah, I'll just walk, it's fine, I know the way. And I started walking and then I found myself in a huge kind of meadow with cows and sheeps and stuff. And I called him and said, and windmills and stuff. And I said, listen, I don't know where I am, but there's a windmill and there's some cows and sheep. He says, yeah, it's Holland. It's all that. But anyway, the reason why I got lost was because I saw a sign the night before saying, Tekoop, which is Tekoop. That's why it's like K-O-O-P. And I recognized that sign, so I thought to myself, I'm on the right track. But it means that it means for sale. So
don't, and it's easy mistake,
and they say Tekoop, like Moog. So but anyway, yeah, it sounds to me like this would be something more desirable for me than the Moog one, which I kind of like, but I didn't see there was something about it that this didn't connect with me. But this one, maybe because of the layout, but also the sound, from what I could tell, it sounds kind of grungy and more, I don't know, less clean, and kind of it sounds like a new.
We'll see about that. I'll tell you one thing that struck me about it is, it's absolutely, there's no dead panel space in it. It's absolutely covered in controls, edge to edge, which I think is a nice thing to see. Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff going on there. So and I'll tell you what it reminded me a little bit of is some of that Yamaha digital era CS range, the CS40 or the CS15, but in the digital one. I know, Paulie, it looks nice. I mean, Mo, you know, you've got a poly brute. Do you need a muse?
Well, that's what I was asking myself, really. Talking of the Yamaha stuff. Talking of the Yamaha stuff, there's obviously polyphonic ring mod on this Moog muse. Which is cool because none of my polys have got an OB6. It's got digital ring mod. I've got a Prophet 600, it's got FM, but none of them have this kind of lovely analogy ring mod in polyphony kind of sound. So that's the thing that kind of tempts me.
That'll
you know,
interesting.
That will be interesting. And there's also a modulation oscillator which can be mixed in. So it looks like it goes up to audio rate because it's there's an audio mixer thing for the modulation oscillator. So I think we're going to get some potential audio rate modulation on everything. You know, maybe a third oscillator that can be running audio rate or LFO mode is what I'm guessing. But there we go. We need one of those CSI enhance things, you know, where
yeah, well, that's
where
the
they
Deckard,
get a still
Deckard,
of it and then
enhance. Yeah, it's Blade Runner, it. The Blade Runner thing where he checks the photograph and sees the reflection in the window. Yeah, well, we could sort of do that. To be honest, I have done that in the past, where there's been teases, especially when they do the contrast thing, because you could do so much stuff where you just heighten the contrast, change the balance, and you can see all the controls of the synth they thought they did in a way. It's easily done.
It's
but it's interesting, isn't it? That it's a Moog, and I guess how would you say, if you were from New York, how would you say Muse? You'd probably go Moose. So it's kind of like a Moog Moose, which is such a weird juxtaposition of how you're supposed to pronounce these things. So,
hey, Polly, get my Moog Muse. There we go.
Moose.
You'll be swimming
Moose
with the fishes.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the U is a bit more pronounced. But exciting. I mean, I guess the next thing that we're going to hear, I don't know what the next step is. Obviously, Super Boob's coming up. I've been banging on to Moog to try and, you know, say, hey, we're going, do you want to? And I haven't had any response because all of that's changed. I'm not dealing with the same people anymore. I don't know who it is that I'm supposed to deal with necessarily. And we haven't made the connection. But I think that the next phase will probably be somebody synthy sitting down and showing the sounds. You know, we'll get a bit more of an idea of what the sonic qualities are like. Maybe Lisa Belladonna or
definitely
somebody like that. Or maybe they'll phone us and say, do you want to review it? But it's not looking too good at the moment, to be honest. Depends how many they've got. I guess the other thing with this is because it's going to be larger manufacturing, a different manufacturing route, maybe they've only got one or two units sort of pre-production rather than a bunch that they might have if they were putting them together in the old Asheville place, which I'm guessing is no longer a thing. I don't know, or certainly that old building.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, there we go.
Can I mention one thing? Just one thing. Yep. It's really odd. I have never owned a Moog synthesizer. Isn't that really weird? You'd think I would have. But most of
not
my analogs, you know, were like Korg and then, you know, a bit of Roland, Polybrew, Sequential. So would this be the...
Did you not mean Roland?
...thing that made me buy...
Roland and Co.
Roland. Roland. Yes, that's it.
That
definitely
should be the title of the show.
What's the thing that the Sparks keyboardist has on his... I think he changes it to Ronald, doesn't he? Instead of Roland.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Ronald.
Yeah, that's cool. Yes. Yeah, so
I mean, either. I only had I got a sub 37. I bought the sub 37 that I got for review, and that was only, well, I guess 8-9 years ago. So that's my only Moog.
My uncle has, I think it was 21 or 24 tracks of monophonic realistic MG1, which is, you know, like a Moog designed monosynth. He stacked them. Because he sent me a demo, we're working on a song together, and I said, oh, this would be a nice bridge. You know, just play some chords here, and it'll be fine. But instead of playing some chords, he tracked 20 or 24 monophonic realistic MG1 lines, and it sounded absolutely incredible. So
I'll bet it did.
I quite like that way of working, you know, stacking monosynths.
That's the interesting though. The thing is, I mean, this is something that's worth bearing in mind, and we've talked about it before. Is like, you know, the classic Moog voice isn't really built for polyphony because it's just too massive. So, but this is where the resonance and I guess you saw a secondary filter in there. I'm guessing there's going to be high pass because you need to thin some of those oscillators out if they're that beefy, aren't they, Richard? I suppose you would.
Well, I would hope that they're both full filters because they've been putting high pass and low pass filters in their synths recently. So it'd be nice if each one was switchable. I couldn't tell from the picture whether it was or not, but it really does seem like they threw the kitchen sink at this thing. This seems like the Poly Moog that everyone wants and wanted the Moog 1 to be. It's because it's sort of knob per function, and it's very hands-on. It really feels like a classic instrument, even though, you know, obviously it's coming out in 2024, hopefully. But I think this is an instrument that everyone is going to be like, oh, that's finally the Pauly Moog that I wanted. It seems when he was playing the chords in the video, it seems like you're able to pull it back enough and get some restraint out of it, which is nice. With two filters, you should be able to find a spot for that in the mix pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's, it should fit. I mean, you know, there's always EQ and stuff. Anyway, good stuff. I'm glad we got that in because, goodness knows, we haven't had... Well, there's not really been any major Moog announcements since the acquisition. Not big ones that I can think of. So, good. I mean, wish them all the well. I mean, it'd be really interesting if they're dropping it down a little bit in price. Because I guess when you consider it against the One... This is much more affordable. And the Moog One was, you know, $5,000. And so this has to be, I think this has, I reckon we could be closer to 2.5, Richard. And we could take bets on it and play some sort of bingo thing, but we'll see. But you could, I bow to your greater knowledge of hardware, I guess. It's just that maybe they've got a bit more economy of scale going on this time, which is hence why they merged up, I suppose. One of the reasons, anyway. Okay, right. What's next? Let's see. I'll just find my I fancy doing this one, but just because it's not often we talk about recording stuff, so I'm going to throw this one in there quickly. So this is Sound Lights and Video Show and episode 26, a guy called Chris May, and they put together... they were trying to emulate... Gosh, I'm trying to remember which track it was. Close to you.
26, when we're going to be looking.
Yeah. I'll pull it for. So, I mean, and the complexity of some of this stuff, the amount of stacking. I shouldn't play it because I imagine I'll get busted for this stuff. So, you know, this is one of those technologies. The Carpenters obviously love them or hate them. They sort of represent a certain style. It's almost like kind of almost too lush and creamy. It's a little bit. It's almost. Perhaps a bit too inoffensive for somebody. You can't deny the fact that Karen Carpenter's voice is quite possibly one of the most pitch-perfect human voices, you know, of its time. I mean, there have been others since. And the way that they built the vocal stylings, the backing vocals, was enabled in some ways through the ability of 16-track technology at the beginning and then 24. And they really knew how to do it. And obviously, brother and sister meant they could record two parts at a time and all of that stuff. But I just thought this was a fascinating thing. And the fact that they went into such detail was interesting. And what happens when you build all of those... put all those voices together, something special happens. So this generated a couple of questions, really. First of all, do people bother doing this sort of thing anymore? Is there any point? You know, even though it's much easier because you can do it in a DAW and it's much easier, there are so many, you know, people use vocoders, harmonizers, all that sort of thing to save the time. Are there people that still do this? I'm talking regularly. I mean, you do get it from time to time, but it doesn't seem to be like, it seems like an art form, that level of multi-tracked overdub vocals that would be in the ascendancy because it's so much easier now. And I thought I'd come to Yoad first because Yoad's probably dealing with way more multi-tracks than we ever are. And how you would apply. Are people still doing much of this kind of thing? This level of vocal production with backing vocals and that sort of triple tracking?
Yes, in my world, I see a lot of... I get sent a lot of stuff to mix where the stacks of backing vocals... And in my productions, I use that a lot. LCR, like tons and tons. I even used to do it on a, when I was working on a 24 track tape and not 48 on some of the projects. Then I used to even bounce like a backing track to a fresh tape, 2-inch tape, to one track or two tracks, and then do the stacks of vocals on 20 tracks or 22 tracks, and then fly it back to a quarter inch, record it back to a quarter inch, and fly it back to the original tape,
yeah,
with the, you know, the old way, without a synchronizer, with the, just marking on the playback head and helping the guides kind of spin and just doing that. So I think that's the Queen way. That's how they used to do all their stacks,
right,
on a 24 track machine. And I definitely, there's nothing like it. And even though I, you know, was very much involved in the Waves Harmony product plugin, which does just that. It eight voices of you know, detune and pitch and pan and kind of randomness and stuff. There's nothing like that, and I think it's definitely worth spending the time to do. The one thing which is an advantage of today's advantage or not, but that's the way I've been doing it for the past 20 years, is to clean those overdubs to death. So taking out all the T's at the end of the line, so you don't get the
right
and all that, and obviously all the breaths and stuff like that. There's a very neat way of doing that in Logic, where you separate the breaths of from the lead vocal, and you end up with just the regions of the breaths, and then you can drag them on to all the stacks to create holes on all the stacks, so you don't have to, you know, to do it kind of individually or even as a group. So that's a neat way of doing that. And I get my mixes all prepped up by my assistants that way. So you get the sound, but you don't get the kind of messiness, even though one can argue that that's some of the magic of those kind of 70s tunes. But I wanted to say something else about Karen Carpenter. First of all, I didn't know that they were active, because in the video he mentions that they were active in the 70s and 80s, which is news to me. I could have checked.
Early 80s, I think there was early 80s. Yeah, there were.
Yeah, because they have such a their sound is such 70s that I was a bit surprised that they were active in the 80s. The other thing is Karen Carpenter played drums on all the... She was the drummer of the band.
She was a really good drummer,
Has amazing sound. But also, apart from that, and that's why, because her snare is such... It's a definition of the 70s kind of hi-fi sound, drum sound. But the way she used to play, she made the hi-hat as important, significant, and big sounding as the kick and the snare. So on some of her drum parts, the hi-hat is like doing the backbeat, and it has a massive sound, so you don't feel like you need anything else. And on a lot of the tracks, it's like normal kind of kick, snare, and the hi-hat is just doing the eights or whatever. But on some of that, the patterns are using, she's using the hi-hat as a drum. And I tried to do that many times, but there's something about her playing and her touch and sound, not to mention the vocal, but just as a drummer. She was amazing.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because they've almost the detail and the clarity. It's almost the sound of that style of backing vocal is almost synthetic sounding, because it's so sort of creamy.
That's what they were going for.
It's very curious.
That's what they were going for. But there was they never had encountered the risk of sounding machine-like, because they were not. And when you try to do something like that today, if you try to use any kind of artificial aids, then you will sound robotic and stuff. Although a lot of the music made today is, you know, kind of using that. So things change, fashions, tastes, and it's all down to technology, and technology dictates the fashion in art in all aspects, not only in music.
Richard, her voice is extraordinary. It's almost, I like it, it's almost like, you know, when you eat some kind of dessert and it's too sweet and it kind of, it's almost too much. Her voice has that effect on me. Sometimes it's just so intensely beautiful, and sometimes you just think, oh, that's so saccharine, it's almost bitter. You know, the way that she's, because she's quite a low register, and the way that she scoops up into from low notes is just, I mean, it's sublime. It's very interesting though, but that, I mean, the ability to take that level and care over backing vocals, I mean, it's obviously a real luxury back then, because studio time was so expensive.
No, but it's listening to that sort of broken out like that is just, it puts you in awe of the talent that she had. But it also, it's inspiring to listen to those tracks, because I can't sing at all, not even a little bit. But I the approach of doing take after take after take and building up something that becomes more than the sum of the parts is I do that a lot with monosynths, where, you know, you do, you want to play a chord, well, you just do three takes of the monosynth, and you can make small changes to the sound between each take to try to add something to it. Now that's a very, it ends up still sounding relatively mechanical and sounding like a synthesizer. But that's inspired by this old way of doing one track at a time. And I think the reason people don't do this type of stuff anymore is because you really don't have to. You know, you can use harmonizers, and all of that stuff is in the box. And because those tools are available now, that's the sound of popular music. I think it would take something like, you know, Beyonce putting out an album where she does 15 tracks of her voice stacked up for people to sit and say, oh yeah, that's cool again. And then I think we would see more of this. But to go back and listen to these separated tracks is, it's a reminder that, you know, how beautiful her voice was and how inspiring it can be to listen to someone that can sing that well.
It's interesting. I mean, just for clarification, that's not the multi-track we were listening to. That's them recreating the multi-track from an analytical thing. So I forget the name of the, I think she's called Ellie, the singer. I didn't go into any more detail, but she obviously did a cracking job of it as well. I know, Paulie, you layer up, you know, you're fond of layering up a vocal or two. I've heard them in your various tracks. Is it?
Yes.
I suppose the thing is if you've already, because I think maybe now we're so used to kind of writing and producing in the same process, technology has become made that frictionless, so we can actually kind of almost arrange on the fly, taking that sort of time to then go back and sort of add all of these things means you need to do it at the right point, because it might slow down your kind of your flow state or whatever. So maybe that's why there's less of it.
Potentially. I think... I've got so many things to say on this. Which one first? I like music where there's an interplay between machinery and humanity. I really dig that. So having an entirely sort of electronic soundscape and then the sort of very grounding effect of real vocal harmonies is something I find really powerful, and it's why... in my track Failure, I dropped everything out of the, you know, bleak dystopian beats and put these harmonies in. So what I tend to do is I'll have four harmonies generally. I'll have sort of tenor range, an alto / mezzo soprano range, a soprano range, and then the bass, and I'll probably sing the tenor and the bass, and then I'll get my friends to do the other two. And then I'll affect them slightly. There's already a lot of rich kind of variety in those voices, and you can spread them out in stereo. But what I'll do is I'll add a little bit of maybe doubling. Even the built-in Cubase doubling modulated delay. can kind of add a bit of space, you know, and it kind of pans it out a little bit more. So I absolutely love getting at least 4 vocal harmony tracks. And I think also music can be very lonely. It can be a very solitary process, and most of the time I'm fine with that in my sort of little autistic den of music making. But sometimes it's really nice to have a story of a song. So I invited some friends around. We recorded some vocal parts. These kind of events and processes are quite life affirming and really positive. And yeah, kind of magical. And the last thing I wanted to say on it is about the magicalness of it. When I first got my first cassette deck, multi-track cassette deck, I think it was a Fostex XR5 multi-tracker. And being able to have the backing track and then harmonize with myself and try things out in around 1990, I think it was about 96, 97, was just absolutely magical and a complete game changer, you know? Mm. And it's something I like to do even to this day, kind of harmonize with myself as well and work out some parts and then get friends in to sing the higher parts better than I could. You know, unless I had some kind of rugby accident just before the recording session, I might be able to sing a bit higher. But other than that, I get some friends in. And one thing I'd like a bit of help with, if you could leave a comment, guys, in the thing below, is I'm going through a lot of my old recordings where I've done sort of multi-track vocals from about the age of 14 to 18. And I'm thinking of making an episode of my YouTube channel going through those old recordings and seeing what I was up to at 14.
Oh, my.
Because
yeah,
some of them are quite good. And I'm just wondering, is it something that people will be interested in seeing? Or is it something I should avoid like the plague? Because some of them are actually not too bad. The recording quality is not great. It's an interesting thought.
It's the vibe.
So let me know.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's fair enough. Okay, gosh, yeah, no, it is the power of voices together is I know Rich feels very strongly about it. When you're in the room and things happen, you know, it's like, where's that other note coming from? It comes from,
yes,
it's not there, it's just magically appeared. Okay, well, in a sort of weird connection to a previous topic, which I sort of jumped, this is an interesting, this Rando Machine, which in the canon of sort of teenage speak, Rando is probably not a great thing to offer, but this is an interesting idea.
If you have no time and only one sample of a kind, can you still make a colourful soundtrack? Easily, if you have Rando Machine.
I'll fast forward this a bit because gunshots
machine
are probably not what we're looking at.
Just choose it if you want to randomize your sound's pitch, panorama or saturation, time offset, space or combination of all 6 effects. Then tell Rando Machine how far it can go. You'll get an endless number of variations with every Rando Machine action. Rando Machine works in 3 modes.
Anyway, so the idea of this, I mean, it's really basic, basically quite simple. I mean, it reminds me of stuff that's been working in Foley for ages, you know, Krotos and things where an Unreal Engine actually has kind of ability to, you put 2 footsteps in and it just kind of, it will randomize all of the, loads of parameters so that they sound different even though they're triggered again and again and again. Mm. And it enables us to kind of, you know, because we're very, very sensitive to repetition, humans, so this sort of thing is quite useful. But there's some great examples in here of just sort of a hi-hat part that's sort of moving about all over the place. You can affect the ambience, you can affect the timing, the formant. I'm not sure I heard things that were terribly high fidelity, but I just thought it was interesting. This is free at the moment. It's normally $50. I think it's free for the next 4 days. Cool. I'm going to come over to you, Yoad, because you know about these things. As a concept, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I don't know about the execution, but what do you think about the idea of this?
Yeah, as a concept, it's you know, very valid. I found that using kind of low pass and pitch, especially on drums, kind of dictated by the velocity. So the higher velocity will pitch the sample up and open the filter, is very, very effective. And I do that on EXS sometimes when I have a single shot that I want to sound a little bit more dynamic, such as snare triggers, especially, and things like that. From what I could hear on the demo, it sounded quite comb filtery. So I'm not sure whether I presume it's the pitch algorithm, which has too much crossfading on the kind of sample and duplicate and add algorithm, and it sounds a little bit resonant. So I wasn't impressed by just judging by that video, especially on that gunshot samples. It sounded a bit metallic, but I downloaded it, and I will check it more, and maybe it's a settings that you can be. I mean, it's something you can do within a studio rec or something like that. You can have sort of you can build your own chain that can do something similar, but obviously it's very convenient and easy to have it as a plugin with dedicated controls and things like that. I'm not convinced about the sound, but I have to check it further.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with this brand, so
I'm not. They're called Sound Device Digital, and it's
so good on them that we're mentioning them, and people can go and check their website, and maybe they have some other cool stuff. I just need, for me, it's about. I mean, it looks nice, and it does. It kind of does something that that people need. It's just a question of how good it sounds.
Yeah, I think that's probably the key. I suppose we've come used to everything sounding fantastic these days. Now with sort of stem separation and everything, we're just going, wow, it's magic. And anything, but it's interesting, isn't it, the idea of randomization? I mean, you know, as an analog developer, you want a certain amount of that, but not too much because it'll be out of tune. But I mean, we are very sensitive to continual precision, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think the user interface of this is brilliant in how simple it is and how it very clearly shows you what it's doing. I think the audio demos, the pitch range that they were swinging, I didn't really appreciate that, but if you would set the pitch part of it to being extremely subtle, I liked how this thing sounded, but it also, again, all this stuff is creatable in other ways, whether it be on an analog instrument or whether it be, you know, on a digital instrument or in a DAW. So even if you don't have this plugin specifically, it's nice to know that you can, adding a little bit of randomization does make a huge difference to how things sound, or just adding an LFO to something and just to get a little bit of change in something. It really does allow your ears to always be hearing something new, and it keeps, whether it be the music or the sounds you're listening to, it keeps them fresh in your mind, and it does make them more interesting. So I think an effect like this, used very subtly, you could use this probably on just about every track as long as you keep it subtle. Now, you could go more extreme for a very obvious effect, but I think it does start to break apart when you do that, and you do start to hear all the problems that it's going to create sonically, and maybe it's a little bit more lo-fi or whatnot, but used in very subtle ways, it really makes a big difference in the overall sound of, you know, whether it be a synth track or a guitar part or someone singing even. I think this is, I think it's really neat. I downloaded it this morning as well. I haven't had a chance to try it out, but it's definitely on the list of things I want to play with.
I guess, Paulie, I mean, in a lot of your digital machines have got such tiny amounts of memory where yeah. that repetition is almost, it's almost a feature, isn't it? You know, some of the kind of the Insonics and the LA Synthesis. But I guess that's the synth engine. It is about programming. And I wasn't totally clear about this, whether you have to trigger a sample with it or whether it works on a real-time input. It must be triggering a sample, I'm guessing, because otherwise it would be, how would it know what was coming, you know? But
sure. Like a kind of like a MIDI trigger or maybe an envelope follower kind of thing. I think this is great for, like, you know, free. And I think, yeah, it should be used in a more subtle range than some of the pitching that they were doing on the demo. But I think this kind of thing is great for bringing life to older sample libraries. You know, sample libraries that are maybe 20 plus years old, because we're kind of used to these days having lots of round robins, lots of velocity layers, you know, scripting and stuff like that. If you go back to older libraries, like, you know, early Sample Tank stuff, Sound Fonts, Giga Sampler, and we're making anyone feel old yet, you can find some really good sounds that unfortunately don't have enough velocity layers or samples for kind of today's discerning ears. So something like this is absolutely brilliant to take those really good but limited older sample libraries and bring them a little bit into the 21st century. We are in the 21st century, aren't we? Yes.
I believe so. I think we're there now. Yeah. No, it's, you could see it working in that fashion as well. Anyway, it's an interesting idea. I mean, and like you say, though, it's the sort of thing that you can program up in a, you know, an Ableton rack or whatever. There's loads of chains that you could do that with. How's everybody fixed for time? I wonder whether we had time to do the just a little bit on flawed instruments, whether that was a thing. Is everybody okay? Johan, are you all right for 5-10 minutes? Yeah. Okay, sure. All right. Well, let's do the... this one is... there's no video for this, but if I press... was it that one? I think that'll work. This was actually by Paulie. So this is just an interesting... Paulie pitched this at the weekend saying, I was thinking about doing something about flawed instruments at release. I wonder whether, you know, how modern should we go so that we don't annoy any modern... any of the current... And so there's a selection of six here. There's a good selection there. And my favourite one is on the Mofo, the DSi Mofo with filter with two eyes that somehow made it onto the screen print of the, maybe that was, I mean, I can't imagine. I suppose I could see how that might happen, because an I and an L close together are kind of, if you're not paying attention, you can kind of,
it's on both filters. It's on the high pass and the low pass. I think they made the mistake twice. So that's why it's so spectacular.
Cut and paste. Cut and paste could not be your friend sometimes. But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we spoke a little bit. We were talking earlier about the Moog Muse, and I would venture that the Moog 1 at release was perhaps flawed, though perhaps not in terms of spelling mistakes or broken or any of those kind of things, but just perhaps not quite ready. And we were also talking pre-show with Paulie about the Polybrew and how that had some interesting firmware quirks, and I'm finding things in the Astrolab too, I suppose the thing is when you get something so badly wrong at initial that it's almost, you know, I can't think of anything that's been irreversible, but there must be legends. No. Richard, there must be legends in the industry that everybody goes, oh, you don't want it to be one of those.
Listen, I'm not here to listen to your hit jobs on instrument designers. This is madness. You guys have to absolutely stop this. These instruments were fine. Come on. You added another eye. That's great. I think it was there on purpose. All these decisions were made. No, the reality of it is a lot of these instruments, and you know, I know this as a designer, are done by very small teams, and you're going to miss stuff now and then. And, you know, firmware if you have a very small set of people testing it, you're going to miss stuff because everyone sort of falls into the rut of using an instrument the way they use it. Yeah. And so if you have the same three people testing, they'll find the quirks in the way that they use it. But, you know, there's a whole nother world out there that maybe they haven't explored in the same way. We run into this, you know, we ran into this right away with the Taiga keyboard. There were some bugs that people found right away. So, you know, we put out a firmware update for it. And you kind of move on. But this is this type of stuff is the stuff I lose sleep over. You know, I stare at panel artwork all day long. I have it up on my computer. And if I have 5 minutes, I'll just – you try to look at it out of the side of your eye and try to catch it differently to catch spelling mistakes or maybe the little graphic image is a little bit low or a little bit high. Yeah, this stuff terrifies me, and I don't think we should talk about it anymore.
PTSD. I'm guessing
there are other. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, in the world of software, I mean, it happens all the time, but it's an easy fix, isn't it? It's just an update, and you can easily reach all of your customer base and go, sorry about that. Here's the thing with filter spelt right in the new graphic or whatever it is. That sort of stuff's easy.
Or you can it's. It's not a bug, it's a feature. That's another approach.
That's true.
I remember it reminds me of the Akai S3000. I don't remember what we did with it one time at the studio late at night, but it kind of froze and it had a message on the screen, call Richard, and then a UK mobile number. So that was kind of something that no one expected to ever happen. I don't remember what we did.
Did you call it?
No, we didn't. It was late at night. So, but anyway, I mean, you know, things happen. And as much as you, I mean, obviously my experience is more with the software side of things. And, and as you know, I worked for Waves for many years and developing, I don't know, over 100 products. And we started very small. So with a very small kind of QA, it wasn't even a department. It was like one person when I joined. And now there's like 12 or 14 or something like that people, plus a huge community of beta testers and things like that. You try as much as you can, but there could only always be, especially with software, because you never know what kind of particular screen graphics card you would have with your Windows 11 on an AMD, blah blah blah. So technical things can always get triggered. In terms of features and stuff, like Richard said, you know, you do whatever you can and you pray that you got it right, and there are no kind of things that would stick out and that you overlooked. But we're all humans, and things happen, and obviously with hardware it's much more. Like once you go into manufacturing and you manufactured, oh, gosh, I don't know, 1,000 really pieces or, you know, then it's a problem, obviously.
Yeah.
I love the Moto, by the way. I think it's a great, great synth. And
the what? Sorry? The
Mofo, the Dave Smith.
Ah,
really good.
I think it was my first ever synth review, the Mofo. I think it was. If I remember correctly. Can't remember now, but I think it might be. I know, Paulie, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, I can speak for myself. I do it daily when I publish a news item and I go, oops, I've mistyped that, or the URL's broken or whatever. But it feels like there's less jeopardy because it's easy to fix. And it doesn't matter, I can fix it. It's not so easy if you get something wrong that then goes out to socials and then everything links back to something that is broken or isn't working properly. But it's the humanity of it, I suppose.
Definitely. And I've got to say, I do own some of these instruments. So it wasn't like I couldn't I can appreciate, you know, an instrument that takes maybe a little longer to bake in the oven. That's absolutely fine by me, as long as manufacturers are, you know, decent at communicating with the audience, and I think that's fine. Because I think some things have happened in the past where instruments have totally been bad-mouthed and run into the ground because of instant firmware issues. You know, there was, I think it was the Korg Prolog, and also the Polyend and Dreadbox Medusa. Those were two very different instruments, but they both had issues with tuning in the initial releases. And that's a kind of thing, I think tuning is crucial to get, because I think then people are like, oh, it's no good, you know, it can't be fixed, it's terrible. And people then pile on, I think. So I think that's the worst one. Having an instrument which out of the factory doesn't have great tuning. Both those instruments, as far as I know, were completely fixed later, but I think they may have lost quite a lot of, you know, market kind of prestige because of those tuning issues, and I think it's a shame. So my next article is not going to be doing any hit jobs on synth manufacturers. I'm going to be doing something in a similar vein. It'll be synthesizers which in their firmware have some kind of hidden feature.
Easter basically. Eggs. Oh, yeah, nice.
Easter eggs,
call,
yeah.
Dave. Call Richard on the fact that I love the idea.
Yeah, yeah,
that.
Call
I think
Richard.
That's a fantastic. Yeah, fantastic.
Whatever you do, call Richard.
Yeah. I wonder how many phone calls he got, or whether it was such an obscure thing.
I'm sure it wasn't him that did it. It was some of his colleagues that yes. kind of pointed it at him.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Oh, the wags. In fact, we have got Nick Howes in the house, and I'm not sure. I think he was with Akai at that point. He might even know something about it. It might have even been him that. Who is this Richard, and why was it? Yeah. Anyway, no, he says no in capital letters. I think that's what he was answering.
That's a firm no.
That's a very firm no. Anyway, well, that's it. I think we're kind of done for this week. But thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. It's been a lovely week. I'm glad we've been able to talk about a wide variety of subjects. And thanks to everybody in the chat. I've got some behind-the-scenes work to do. For some reason, the actual IRC page is not loading up anymore, and I need to check that out. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I'll get onto it, I hope, for next week. So, Richard, thank you very much for joining us. I guess you're probably starting to pack for, well, maybe not just yet, but Superboot. We'll see you in Berlin, I hope, where the weather will be glorious, and we will walk around in shorts and sandals and sun hats.
I set up our Superbooth table at the shop this week just to make sure that we were going to have room on the table to fit everything. We've got a new instrument that we're going to be announcing at Superbooth. So between that and the Taiga keyboard and the Taiga, you know, there's only so much room on those tables. So we went, we added shelves this year. So there will be shelves Good on plan. Our Superbooth table. But I'm looking forward to Superbooth so much. It's my favorite week of the year, just to be around the music, around the people. I absolutely can't wait to go.
Yeah, it's going to be good fun. Anyway, well, lovely to have you, Richard. We'll see you again very soon, I hope. And, of course, Paulie, who is there, I guess, we're not mixing now. You've got a bit more free time, so are you just... A bit more free time, right.
I'm going to be doing a few deep dives, YouTube deep dives, on a couple of newer instruments, you know, like the Drumlog and the Waldorf M, because that's got some cool new functionality, so... I'm going to film a few deep dives, maybe a few 5 minutes on various things for Sonic State as well. You know, use that time to record some cool stuff. And I get kind of mindfulness meditation out of it as well, you know, doing these kind of exploring an instrument. It's kind of the way I relax, really.
So that's great. Good. Well, I'm glad to be of service.
No worries.
Well, anyway... Thank you very much. And of course, Yoad, I expect, will alt tab into an Atmos mix or something or other that requires his full attention. Lovely to see you, Yoad. I hope you have a fruitful week ahead of you.
Thank you. Yeah, I wish I could come to Superbooth, but unfortunately, I'm too busy in here, which I'm not complaining about.
Well, we
about.
Did see. Great, was it last year or the year before? We don't. Well, I think we
no,
went out for dinner,
before.
Didn't we? The year before, okay.
And it was with Dom as well.
Yes, of course. That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's
and
true.
With Dave Smith.
That. Yes. Good niche. Crikey.
And both of them are no longer with us, sadly.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I won't be joining you this year, but.
Oh, it's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have fun. We've got a full team. We've booked our flights. We've booked our hotel. I think everything is kind of, fingers crossed, all coming together, and it'll all work. We've just got to make sure that the back end. I was doing some back end work yesterday on the workflow because there are things that change. Because from Superbooth, the network in the field is so bad that we can't upload from our phones. We have to go back to a room, and that means we have to dump the footage off the cameras into another place, which means the workflow is different. We use this thing called a Blackmagic Cloud Pod, which is just a syncs with Google Drive, but it doesn't sync with shared Google Drives, which is where the workflow has been working. So anyway, all of that boring stuff. But it's all fixed. It'll be fine.
Fun.
It's all going to be fantastic. So thank you, everybody. We will see you all next time. I hope everybody's enjoyed the show. Thanks to everybody in the chat room and everything. And don't forget, if you're a Patreon supporter, do leave a comment on our feedback article, because we're very keen to make some tweaks and changes to, and we want to know what you think. Anyway, that's it. Sonic Talk episode 798. We'll see you next week. Cheers. Bye, everybody. Take care now.